maybe 2 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, you could prompt an entire, you know, Amaranth record just by writing new Amaranth record with,
Yeah.
you know, kind of these influences, or maybe just that one prompt. But I think at the end of the day, what people are interested in is they're maybe not so interested in the music itself always. They're really interested in what came before the music, what influenced the music, what are the emotions behind it. And without that, I'm not sure how meaningful the music really is.
This is a test. This station is conducting a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
It took ages to get this episode with Olaf Mork, guitarist and composer, one of them anyway. Singer Elise Reed shares songwriting duties in the Swedish heavy metal band Amaranthe. We were supposed to do it before Christmas. Remember Christmas? That feels like a very long time ago, does it not? But for various reasons, we couldn't quite get on a Zoom at the same time as each other. Olaf is a busy man right now. Amaranthe are due to release their seventh record, the ridiculously ambitious The Catalyst on Nuclear Blast. That record comes on February 23rd, keep an eye out. And it's a collection of big songs full of big ideas. AI, transhumanism, the fusion of flesh and machine. And as long-time listeners of this podcast will know, that's very much my thing. Not an execution, obviously. I don't much fancy being an android anytime soon. But the weird stuff, the science fiction teetering on reality, the strange and the surreal, I'm all about that. And I'm pleased that me and Olaf finally found the time to talk, even if our conversation did end pretty abruptly at the end. Hey, it's not his fault. I did spend a good 5 minutes wanging on about my dead dad and the late BBC DJ, Steve Wright. You know what I'm going to say now, don't you? Yes, you do. Yes, that's right. I'm going to say, if you'd like to support the podcast, keep it sounding spick and span, not to mention keeping it open for business, then I'd really appreciate you considering subscribing to the James McMahon Music Podcast Patreon, link in the show notes. Not only that, but if you enjoyed this episode, if you enjoyed what we do here, then please do leave a rating and a review on Spotify or Apple or wherever you listen to podcasts. Or why not tell your music mad friends about the podcast? We go all over the musical map on this podcast. Indie, metal, grime, classical, goth, electronica, post-rock, punk. I'm sure there's a genre we haven't got to yet, but give it time and we will get there. Actually, why not tell me who you'd like to hear interviewed on the podcast? You can tweet me and tell me at James Jam McMahon. That's at James Jam McMahon. That's basically my name with the word jam shunted in between my first name and my surname. James Jam McMahon. Don't ask, it's a long story. You got it? You got it. And with that out of the way, let's get on with the episode. Then here we go. Like you were saying, it's taken a while to get this going. So thank you for persevering with me.
My pleasure entirely.
I guess we'll start with how you doing. That seems the polite place to start.
I'm doing fantastic. We're going on tour in just a little bit over a week. So that's really exciting, and the album will be out in 10 days, a week and a half. So it's very exciting times. How about yourself?
Good, actually. Yeah, no, actually, to be honest,
I'll be honest. I'll be dead honest. There's a very famous DJ in Britain who was kind of like the voice, like a radio DJ. He was kind of like the voice of my childhood, really. And he just died. And it shook me up a little bit. You know, the way that, you know, he was quite young. He was 69. His name's Steve Wright. And but he really was, you know, if you put the radio on for 20 years, like, he was always on the radio. You know, he was like one of the most familiar voices in the country. And, you know, I don't know.
That's really terrible.
I don't know whether you've ever lost anyone. I'm sure you've lost someone, you know, it's just, that's just life. But, you know, when something happens in the world and you are immediately taken back to a place of having lost someone, you know, so like when I, when this DJ died, but when I saw that news, I immediately went back to thinking about being a kid and being in the car with my dad, who passed away about 18 months ago. And I was just thinking about how, I don't know, it's almost like you sort of, you lose someone all over again, in a sense. I know that sort of sounds like I'm making the death of a radio DJ kind of all about me and my dad, but it just immediately made me think of my dad, and it kind of just, it floors you, doesn't it? You know, it's like you kind of, I feel like when you love someone who dies, they just keep dying, you know, every time you have a memory of
them. I know exactly. I mean, I lost my dad, let's see, 15 years ago, roughly speaking, and he was pretty young then also, of course.
Yeah.
So I know everything about the associations to it, like when there's kind of like a similar thing that happens, or like a similar pattern or whatever, it does take you back. So I know exactly what you mean. And I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. You must have been very, you must have been very young. He and you must have been very young.
Yeah, so he was 57 and I would have been 26 at the time.
Oh, I'm really sorry to hear about that. You've got one of those faces where you could be like, you could either be like a sort of 150 years old, or you could be like 20. You've just got this sort of like, you've just got this fairly timeless look about you.
Yeah, people can have a hard time placing it sometimes.
yeah, totally.
In terms of age, yeah.
Listen, let's transition into the music. So, I think this record is, what I really like about The Catalyst is that it feels super ambitious, even for what your band does. Was that conscious? Were you really trying to kind of push the envelope with it?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think the context of the situation was obviously the pandemic to begin with. And what it gave us, besides the fact that it was crappy for, you know, the absolute majority of the population, there was, and for us as well, who couldn't go out and, you know, play shows in support of the Manifest album, you know, all these things. And obviously that was really sad, and it was a weird spot to be in. But what the silver lining was that it gave us quite a bit of time. And we told each other, like, let's not dive directly into writing a new album, like, right after Manifest, because that was out in, you know, the end of 2020. So like, okay, let's take half a year, 6 months to just like reevaluate, you know, not rethink, but just get some distance on things, because we had been touring, you know, nonstop for 10 years. And one of the things that came to me pretty early was that I really felt like working on an album, start to do the concept kind of early, because I knew that it would give us the luxury of time. And, you know, any artist on any professional level will say that it can be a little bit difficult to combine composing with touring and, you know, all these things. So that was one aspect that we had plenty of time. So that kind of, informed us that it gave us the tools to up the ante, so to speak. But also, like, the reception that we got for Manifest was really, really good. And that was obviously very inspiring and very motivating, even if you're kind of, at the end of the day, as an artist and a composer, you're kind of writing a lot of music for yourself, you know. But if people respond to it, and if they, you know, emotionally connect with it, that's going to be a great motivational factor. So one of the things that me and Elise, and we are like the two composers in the band, that we said from the beginning was, let's try to push the envelope. Let's see, you know, how far we can take this. Let's keep an open mind to influences and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I never spent for an Amaranth record. I never spent anywhere close to this amount of time to work on an album. So yeah, I mean, in very, very many ways, it was an ambitious project. So yeah, I'm really happy that it comes across.
I mean, unquestionably, it's really interesting when you say that you were aware during the pandemic that you would have a lot of time, because Manifest comes out October. So it's like we're quite far into the pandemic at that point. But I think a lot of people were hoping at that point that, you know, I remember thinking, you know, like everyone else, I was scared shitless when the world started shutting down. And there was probably a little part of me that was like, this is it now. Like all these things that I love about life, life's going to look very different from now on. But I think kind of from sort of 6 months, 7 months on from that, I was thinking, okay, this is about what it looks like at the end of this. Like this isn't going to last forever. But not everyone felt like that. Some people are still sort of marooned on planet COVID, and I don't think they've really accepted that it is over, and I find that very sad. But also, I guess what I'm trying to say is it must have took you some kind of maturity or calm or composure to think, okay, there's an opportunity here, in order to, like, we can take our time. Is that how you saw it? Because yeah, I imagine as a creative person, it must have been quite debilitating thinking, well, is anyone even going to hear what we do, even if we do take our time with it?
Yeah, I mean, that was the cool thing, that because obviously, initially, we were kind of thinking in those terms, as you just mentioned, like releasing an album now in the middle of the pandemic, we can't, you know, support with the tour and so on and so forth. So exactly as you say, like, are people really going to hear it? And when the response was so good, and when it streamed much better than the previous album that was supported by a tour, then, you know, the obvious answer was a resounding yes, at least to that question. But seen from our perspective, was that rather than, you know, having the calm composure and, you know, a slight gift of foresight, the way that it worked for us is that, let's say that we are in November of 2020, we're planning, usually you have to plan a tour 8, 9, 10 months ahead, or even more, like a year ahead. So if we were still in the pandemic then, even if the pandemic would have stopped dead in its tracks in, you know, December of 2020, we still have to plan the tour. So that's still going to leave you a very, you know, huge chunk of time to work on things. And that's something that, you know, especially the metal fans, because you have a much broader insight into the business, you know, than the average metal fan. But the average metal fan, they will probably not understand, you know, the amount of time that goes into planning a tour and then canceling it. Same thing with the promoters. They were being super careful with scheduling anything until they knew for a fact that, you know, the pandemic was kind of over. So these were the factors that we were dealing with at the time. And rather than panic about it, because there was a side of me that thought exactly what you said before, also that maybe this is just the new normal. And a lot of people were being a little bit defeatist about it, you know, other people in the scene, that, okay, I guess live music is over forever now. And, you know, instead of playing shows, we will do these live streams. And I felt like, yeah, but looking at pandemics historically, even the Black Plague, the Black Death, its ending point, you know, sooner or later, things, you know, just pass through the population. So that was just kind of the mindset that I had looking historically at all the previous pandemics. But I had a gut feeling that it was not going to take a few months. It's probably going to take a couple of years, because that's what it looks like historically, basically.
Yeah, that's really smart. It's funny you mentioned those live streams. I found that really interesting how as soon as everything started shutting down, everyone started rushing to live streams. And I thought that that was dead interesting in a sense, because part of me used to look at acts and be like, just pace yourself. This could take a time. And they were doing like live streams like every night. But I think that in a way, it was almost like people trying to make sense of something which didn't, you know, they were trying to make sense of this sort of amorphous situation, and performing and connecting with people was actually what was making them feel better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it was industrious, and it was innovative in a way. And some of the live streams were even really, really good, actually. But I was just feeling that it's not really the same thing. It's not really replacing live shows. It's maybe the second best thing that we have right now. But we realized that that stuff really wasn't for us. For us, a live performance is all about the interaction with the crowd. Like literally, it's what we feed upon. Like we play for the audience, they feed something back, and you know, so it goes. So for us, that would probably not have worked really well. So I'm happy that didn't become a big thing that you needed to do now, because nobody's doing live streams at all of full concert these days. So I'm quite happy about that, actually.
Yeah, no, that is really good. You were saying about themes of the record. Is that how, you know, is it literally when you approach a new record, is it as pragmatic as that? Is it literally about thinking, well, what's this record about, and what do we want to explore on this record? You know, I speak to some acts that it feels a little bit more sort of organic than that, but I'm not saying either way is particularly better than the other.
No, I think it's a little bit of both, because typically I wouldn't put up too many boundaries and too much framework before I start to, you know, get down and gritty with details, because I like to kind of see what comes out, because at the end of the day, when you're working on music or any creative endeavor, like regardless if you're a writer, a poet, or, you know, a visual artist, a painter, I think at the end of the day, it's always, you know, your subconscious plays a very large part in that. And it's kind of cool that you have this ultimate person that is usually not, you're usually, you know, just trying to control that force, you know, that subconscious thing. But what you're doing when you're working with creative things is that you're letting that other person, if you will, speak. And it's good to really listen to that voice before you try to limit it and before you try to frame it, because it might have something very different to say than what you intend to say, you know, yourself. So, I mean, that's what I do in the beginning of any album recording, is that I do a lot of concepts. I do a lot of experimenting, and Elise does the same. And we kind of see where it goes. And once it has gone somewhere, and once you kind of get an idea and an understanding where your subconscious want to go, then you can start to kind of frame it and narrow it down a little bit, and, you know, kind of structure it to make it a little bit more, a bit more structured, simply. So, I mean, that's always a really interesting process. And in terms of thematics for this album, that's kind of exactly what we did. Roughly speaking, halfway through the album, we were looking at the music and lyrics, and we were kind of figuring, like, what is this all about? Like, what are the thematics here? And what we noticed was that a strong thematic was the concept of change, and the very moment that the trigger for that change, which then became, you know, the catalyst, have this moment that acts like a catalyst, both on the micro scale and on the macro scale, so to speak. So it can be anything from a trigger moment in a relationship, to anything, you know, happening globally in the world, basically. So we thought it was a very interesting concept or a theme, because it was kind of loose. So it means that we can do a lot of different things while there's still this overarching kind of theme to it.
Yeah, it's funny. I think about that quite a lot, actually, sometimes when things happen in my life and I think, I wonder if I can pinpoint this. I wonder if I can pinpoint the exact moment where this went in one direction rather than the other. It's a bit of a sort of a pointless exercise, really, other than just sort of maybe trying to avoid mistakes in the future to try and learn from things. But it is interesting when you do kind of cast your mind back and go, if I'd done that differently, then this wouldn't be happening now.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the really interesting point, because change in general is very interesting. And we as human beings, we tend to fear it, even if there's a positive change. It's something unfamiliar, so we tend to respond initially, at least negatively, to it. And then it might turn out to be the most amazing thing ever. But usually change is a linked series of events where one step leads into the other, right? But then you have a great many changes in your life that are, let's say, for the better, that are actually based upon this one incident, this one decision that you took to go to this location, this establishment, to meet up that friend. And then from there, you can kind of see that your entire life just diverged into a totally different path. Let me take a concrete example. Like back in 2006, I met the singer Elise for the first time. And that was just one of these completely serendipitous moments, because it was at a bar that I would usually not really go to. And it was a conversation that was kind of randomly initiated. But from there, we started this, you know, this project. It took off really quite well. The friendship is also amazing. So you have all these linked events. Like, if I wouldn't have gone to that place, my life today could look completely different.
Yeah.
Just to give you one example.
Yeah, I'm pleased that you spun that. That you spun that to a positive, because I was going. I immediately went to the negative with it, but there are plenty of examples I could think of things. I mean, a lot of it's just sort of offering yourself to the cosmos, really, kind of making yourself available. I think that's sometimes where the positive changes come from.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm a big fan of the sleeve. I'm a big fan of you know, artists like Geiger, and I'm very interested in the idea of sort of like the melding of, you know, sort of sci-fi tropes, really, the melding of us with technology, things like that spook me, but I'm also really interested in them as well. How much of what is presented on the cover, and for the benefit of people who haven't seen the cover, it's a sort of, it's kind of everything I've described, really, but how much of that is kind of within, those themes are within the music, and how much of it is just a cool visual device to hold the music?
I mean, it's definitely both, because the cool thing when you're working with music, since we're not, because as you mentioned, like that concept, you know, man meets machine into this kind of, you know, artificial intelligence kind of being, it's definitely a trope. But if it would have been within, you know, a movie context, then you have to think about it totally differently, and you really have to come up with something totally, you know, new. But for us, it's more about invoking that kind of, you know, that kind of universe and that kind of setting, if you know what I mean. Just to tell people that, you know, these stories, they kind of exist a little bit within this world, not exclusively within this world. But so exactly as you say, I'm a huge Geiger fan myself. I watched the second Aliens movie. So Aliens, the second Alien movie, when I was way too young. My dad really loved it. And he's like, yeah, you know, my son, he can take it. When I was maybe 7 or 8 or something like that.
Right,
and
I've
been in love with that universe since then, you know, also that visual style. And there's an obvious reference to, you like, let's say Ghost in the Shell, but even Renaissance paintings. So these were the themes that we were playing around with. And the guy who made the cover, Emmanuel Chiu, he usually does, he actually did the concept art for the latest Blade Runner movie.
Oh, right.
Like the most of it. He also does, done, some Marvel and Game of Thrones and all kinds of stuff, but he's really well versed with that, this kind of visual style. So it was really exciting to work with somebody who is, you know, on that level, has actually worked with the Blade Runner 2047 movie itself, you know, the very sequel to, you know, the movie that kind of started that, those visual stylistics for real, let's say the cyberpunk of the 80s. And, you know, there was only cyberpunk before that, but it was more like descriptions and the written word. And after the Blade Runner movie, then you kind of had a visual standard to what it should look like. And he was working with the sequel. So that was really, really interesting. So, and we're obviously dealing quite a bit with the themes like artificial intelligence, for example. To put things into context, like... what the Catalyst song is about, and a little bit of an overarching theme as well, is that catalytic moment, that watershed where artificial intelligence becomes truly sentient. Right. So kind of like that singularity moment, because that's really all about, yeah, that's a long chain of events. That's a lot of research that is behind it, you know, 70, 80 years of computer technology in one form or the other. But it's that moment where it actually becomes sentient, if at all possible, which serves as a catalyst in this case. And it's a scary scenario. It's a very interesting scenario. And it's something that we're also building the live show around also. So it will have a different intro than the album. And it will kind of, the idea is to transport people into this world, which is the new album.
Oh, well, that sounds very exciting. I feel, I mean, it's almost irrelevant whether I feel conflicted about AI or not, because it's happening. You know, we're so far down the line now. You're not putting any genie back in the bottle, so to speak. But I also think there's so much sort of negativity around the topic. And I, in so many ways, I'm excited. I I was listening to a podcast the other day where someone was talking about how they've been using AI to decode or understand the language patterns of whales. So there are people who are having conversations with whales, and also anyone who's ever lost anyone to an illness, you know, an incurable illness. Like, we're going to cure those illnesses because of AI. It's just, there's going to be so many benefits. But also, we are unquestionably standing on the precipice of incredible change that I just don't even know whether we know how seismic it's going to be yet. I would imagine, as a creative person who, I mean, everyone is going to be impacted by the explosion of AI, but I would imagine there's a lot of conversation about coming from creative people about how it's going to affect what they do. How do you feel about all that?
It is a very interesting topic, and it's something that I talked a little bit, you know, because of the thematics on this album, I talked a little bit about it, and it's very interesting because these kind of conversations, like with yourself, it kind of helped me to frame and form a little bit of an opinion, and even venture a little bit of a prediction around it. Because the interesting thing with creative endeavors, it depends a little bit on what it is. Because if it's something, you know, in terms of what we do, which is something that is very, very emotional, like the music that we compose, and maybe most of all when we're standing on stage performing the music, it's something that is going to be preciously hard to replace. And obviously, you know, down the line, maybe 2 years from now, maybe 10 years from now, you could prompt an entire, you know, Amaranth record just by writing new Amaranth record with, you know, kind of these influences, or maybe just that one prompt. But I think at the end of the day, what people are interested in is they're maybe not so interested in the music itself always. They're really interested in what came before the music, what influenced the music, what are the emotions behind it. And without that, I'm not sure how meaningful the music really is. Like one comparison or metaphor that I take is that we've been having, you know, this very simple form of AI programming for computer games, where you have AI bots, you know, playing Counter-Strike or StarCraft or something like that. And then they've been able to play against each other for, you know, 25 years. But nobody watches any matches with them, because if there's not a human behind it, it's kind of not really interesting to people. Yeah. So they will want to know that there is a human behind it. And they will do everything that they can to verify that, you know, this Amaranth record was not prompted. It was actually made by these people that I'm going to see live. And if they see slightest hint that we just cheated and prompted something, you know, they're going to pull out the pitchforks, basically. So, and I think you can see that also with Midjourney. Like, you could prompt some really amazing album art, album covers already 2 years ago. And it's actually surprisingly few has used it. It has been used a couple of times. I've seen lately a couple of bigger artists that you can see that it was used a little bit. But it was not the total death of, you know, creatives doing album artwork, for example, as people predicted it to be. But it's exactly like you say, we're standing on the precipice, and it's really hard to say exactly how it's going to impact everyone. We just know that it is going to impact everyone. But I think the big safe zone for any artist who is in my position is obviously the live shows, because it's going to be totally pointless to have androids, you know, going around touring. I know that both ABBA and KISS are going down this route, and I think it falls a little bit within the realm of live stream shows, but even worse in a way. It's a lot like just watching a screen with someone performing.
Yeah, I mean, we've been again, you've been sort of discussing technology. You've said a few times, like, we've been able to do this for a couple of years and no one's really done it. I remember when there was so much hype about, hype and fear about the idea of hologram acts, you know, when they had Tupac appearing from beyond the grave, and that hasn't really transpired. Like, there hasn't been loads of artists rushing to, I don't know, put Elvis back on the stage, you know. So I do think that the market is kind of dictated by what people sort of feel comfortable with, in a sense. You know, it's like thing when AI comes to creativity, the thing that I feel quite excited about is I wonder whether it puts more of a premium on humans, in a sense that I sometimes find that art, culture, media you know, for all of the choice that we have in 2024, I often think that art has become quite homogenized. I feel like people's opinions are very similar. I feel like it's quite hard, actually, for, you know, eccentrics, mavericks, weirdos to stand out. And I actually wonder that as AI gets more capable of doing things that sort of anyone could do, actually the people who are really out there on the edge are going to become more desired and valuable.
And I really think the same thing. It's almost something that is kind of inevitable in a way, because you would need to constantly calibrate. Unless you have a completely sentient AI, you will always need to kind of push it in a certain direction, like be original, do something different. And I think this is something that is going to be, it's going to be very, very difficult to do that, essentially. What AI will always excel at is to do something that appeals to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
With when it has as many examples of to learn from as possible, until it becomes, you know, truly intelligent. And I think that, combined with the factor that there will always be an uncanny valley, you know, and we as human beings, we're very, very sensitive to it. Let me take another example, because I saw on the news back in, I think it was maybe 30 years ago in 95 or something, that people were saying that, okay, like after Jurassic Park, CGI is so good that it's very likely to replace actors within the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
People were worried about it, and they're worried about it now with AI as well. And it got really good, you know, CGI human beings. They got really, really good already 15, 20 years ago, and they've gotten not much better since then.
Yeah.
Because our brains are, when it comes to human emotions and human expressions, our brains are very, very expertly trained on this to pick up the just slightest little weird thing.
Yeah.
So that's a big factor as well.
Yeah. I also think as well, I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of fantasy and horror and those sorts of genres. And I actually think that people, you know, I get very excited when I hear that animatronics are being used in movies. I get very excited when I hear that puppets are being used in movies. And I think a lot of that is because of the saturation of CGI, and also the kind of the cheap sort of conveyor belt kind of approach to CGI as well. So I think that basically you've made me feel a lot better about this, Olaf.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I will actually have to unfortunately leave you now, because I have the other interview that started already 5 minutes ago. So
do you know what?
I'm sorry about that.
It's fine. I was thinking that was the case. I was thinking there was about two or three things I was going to ask you, and I was thinking they're all kind of things you're supposed to ask people when you're talking to them about the new record, but they weren't especially interesting, really, and I would have just kept going with AI and weird future transhumanism. But it's been so nice to speak to you, and thank you so much for giving me some of your time, and I think the new record is really exciting, and I can't wait to see where it takes you.
Yeah, thank you so much, James. Really, really interesting conversation. And I think since all of these things connect really well to the album also, I think this is a much more interesting way to talk about it.
Oh, fantastic. I'm pleased to hear it. Okay, well, have a nice day. Speak to you later.
Yeah, you too. Take care, man.
Well, that was episode 247. Thanks to Olaf for the chat. Thanks to Claire Harris for hooking us up. The theme tune is by the band This. And I'll see you soon. James.